perfectly in all areas, though, or he'd be less ready to distrust all adults interested in taking him in. In debates over whether Bruce Wayne's parents were raising him Catholic or Episcopalian, those who focus on his great guilt as their proof that he must be Catholic, aside from stereotyping, are underestimating many people's capacity for guilt. Anger motivates him more than guilt, and more than anger, the need to look out for others, because there was no one to look out for the family Wayne, takes priority. "My anger outweighs my guilt," he tells Henri Ducard in Batman Begins. Would-be father figure Ducard, out to replace the Wayne's ideals with his own, while overestimating how much he and Bruce have in common, tries to manipulate the type of guilt he assumes Bruce has buried beneath his rage in order to turn the young man against his birth father. "Your parents' death was not your fault. It was your father's. Anger does not change the fact that your father failed to act." This truth Ducard wants him to confront doesn't convince Bruce Wayne. He stays loyal to his parents' memory, even if he has yet to reconcile his need for violence with the values they promoted. He quests not for their ghost's approval, so he thinks. Attachment. What happens when catastrophic circumstances cut children off from their parents? Attachment theory, an important idea in developmental psychology regarding the dynamics of long-term relationships, arose in answer to such a question. During the Blitz of World War II, when Nazi Germany spent months repeatedly bombing London plus other British military and industrial centers, trying to damage the British war economy and demoralize the British into surrendering, the air raid's ongoing threat kept citizens afraid for their lives and terrified for the safety of those who meant most to them, their children. Over a quarter of London's population evacuated to the countryside. Not all displaced families had anywhere to go, but some citizens who lived in those more remote areas volunteered to take in war orphans and to house other people's children. Later, families reunited. Physically, the children had come out fine. Psychologically, they had not. Separated from their parents at a crucial developmental period, they grew into adolescents and young adults displaying an alarming variety of psychological disorders and relationship difficulties. Familial disruption during the formative years had thrown them off track. Trying to make sense of the mass child evacuation's long-term consequences, psychologist John Bowlby launched a long line of studies on parent-child bonds. Mary Ainsworth, building on his work, concluded that people have different attachment styles, patterns in how people bond and seek closeness from others. Infants attach to adults who meet their needs with consistent sensitive care. The strength of infants' attachment to familiar people, particularly their primary caregivers, predicts their tendencies to connect to others throughout their lives. Consistent with Eric Erickson's idea that infants develop lifelong readiness to trust or mistrust, depending on how dependably parents provide for them, parental responses sculpt their children's attachment styles, which in turn shape the growing individual's feelings, thoughts, and expectations in later relationships. Ainsworth originally identified three main patterns, one secure and two insecure styles. The securely attached child, feeling safe and supported, will freely explore the environment and engage with strangers when the primary caregiver is present. Visibly distressed if the parent leaves the child in a strange situation, this child will be happy upon the parent's return. The anxious, ambivalent child has mixed feelings, having received enough attention and interaction to want the parent, but too inconsistently to trust. Afraid to explore, wary of strangers, and distressed if the parent departs, this child keeps close, and yet after the parent returns from briefly stepping outside, shows the parent resentment and resists when the parent initiates interaction. The anxious, avoidant child has been neglected. The child avoids or ignores caregivers and other adults, doesn't explore much, shows little emotion when parents depart or return, and in fact shows limited emotional range regardless of the situation. Because expressions of feelings and needs have gone too often unrewarded, the child expects communication to have little effect. In adulthood, people can avoid intimacy for different reasons. The avoidant adult who wants connections to others but is too scared to interact is fearful avoidant, while the one who really doesn't care is dismissing avoidant. Mary Main later added a fourth childhood style, disorganized, for children who lack any coherent pattern of coping with others. The ambivalent and avoidant styles, while less effective than the secure, are nevertheless strategies for human interactions. Disorganized children mostly know fear. Their caregivers come across to them as either frightened or, like Scarecrow Jonathan Crane's grandmother, frightening. Interactions are so erratic that the child develops no interpersonal perspective, no general expectations about human behavior, no coherent sense of self. The securely attached person shows grief following serious losses, feels less anger toward whomever they lost, and suffers less depression than the insecure types. Bereavement leads to greater personal growth among the securely attached, although throughout all the styles, violent death yields more complicated grief responses than nonviolent. As noted with the consequences of the London Blitz evacuations, disruptions to family life in violent times can reroute attachment styles and muddle or ruin interpersonal expectations. Some people adapt to loss and interruptions by withdrawing from others, attempting to use avoidance to reduce the pain and fear of further loss. It helps some, it hinders others. Trauma, unresolved mourning, and other disruptions increase disorganization. When previous expectations no longer fit new circumstances, the child's very personality may go into turmoil. Bruce Wayne shows characteristics of both secure and dismissing avoidant attachment. For someone who so values his independence and self-sufficiency, he has spent a lot of time learning from mentors, teaming up with other crime fighters, training apprentices, and relying on the assistance and cooperation of a police commissioner and family butler. He cycles between dealing only with those last two and working with a sprawling, extended Bat family. If he completed the Experiences in Close Relationships scale, one test that measures attachment styles in adults, with complete honesty, he'd peg every avoidance item on the list as a good fit for himself. Consider these sample avoidance statements. I prefer not to show a partner how I feel deep down. Just when my partner starts to get close to me, I find myself pulling away. I don't feel comfortable opening up to romantic partners. I don't mind asking romantic partners for comfort, advice, or help. Reversed. I tell my partner just about everything. Reversed. I find it relatively easy to get close to my partner. Reversed. Terrible things exist in this world. He knows that well. Crime, despair, and decadence abound. As if all the gangsters and drug lords and killers of the kind who took his parents weren't enough, sadists and serial monsters motivated by delights darker than economic need and greed are out there to destroy lives for their own amusement or to satisfy other cravings. Despite all that, Batman is, in his own way, oddly optimistic. He believes in love. He believes in warm, trusting families who deserve better than to suffer at the whims of the dangerous minority. He believes in rehabilitation, even offering it to the Joker right after the clown has shot and paralyzed Barbara Gordon. We could work together. I could rehabilitate you. You needn't be out there on the edge anymore. You needn't be alone. We don't have to kill each other. It's a qualified belief, though, as he can be skeptical, and rightly so, when criminals like the Riddler and Penguin profess to turn a new leaf and go straight. He keeps an eye on them while hoping it works out for the better. The mugger who taught him bloodshed adds to Bruce's education about life without erasing the lessons his optimistic parents already imparted. As Bruce tells his would-be father figure during Batman Begins, his enemy who, in the name of justice, wants to destroy the city his parents believed in, Gotham isn't beyond saving. Give me more time. There are good people here. Antisocial personality disorder appears more commonly among dismissing avoidant adults. But Batman's better-known nemeses act like ambivalent children, both resenting him and aching for his attention. The comic book incarnation of Henri Ducard, an unethical mentor who taught Bruce detective skills, not secretly Ra's al Ghul, observes that Batman functions as a lightning rod for grandiose criminals ostensibly motivated by greed, revenge, or power, when their true agenda is always the same, to cast Batman in the role of nemesis. Hence the puns, the riddles, the flagrant clues in their collective wake, daring their foe to penetrate the obvious. He always triumphs. If he failed, they'd be bereft. The pas de deux would have no point. Like naughty children, who tempt the wrath of a stern, demanding father. They seek only to shock him by the enormity of their transgressions. It's the moment of acknowledgement they crave. The bad fathers. Ducard is one example of a failed father figure. Training Bruce as a manhunter, Detective Henri Ducard shows him the uses of viciousness, cunning, and deception. Amoral, ruthless Ducard works for criminals as often as he does the law. Outraged when Ducard's effort to track a fugitive leads unnecessarily to the man's death, Bruce shouts, "You become as bad as anyone you hunt." The smug mentor tells him, "No, I have not become. I always was. I am, as are you." Both eventually regret having parted on such terms. Years later, Ducard deduces Batman's identity, but keeps it to himself. By investigating purchases of supplies and equipment Batman needs, Ra's al Ghul has already figured his identity out before they first meet. A voice in the Batcave greets him. "Welcome home, Bruce Wayne. Or shall I address you as the Batman?" A mission to find who has abducted Al Ghul's daughter Talia and Batman's ward Dick Grayson turns out to have been staged by Ra's to test Batman's potential as a worthy son-in-law and successor to run Al Ghul's vast organization. His subsequent appearances reveal both the depths of his organization's criminal nature and the heights of Ra's al Ghul's drive to save the world from its people. Time and again, Batman rejects him. Time and again, Al Ghul insinuates himself into Batman's life in ways unlike any other foe. When Al Ghul plots to kill billions of those darn people who crowd the planet, he digs into the Wayne's graves and steals their bodies to throw Batman off his game. And when he needs the Justice League out of the way in that same story arc, he steals Batman's own files on how to neutralize them one by one, thereby alienating Batman from that surrogate family of heroes for some time to come. Their relationship grows progressively antagonistic, and yet after Al Ghul's death, Batman performs what would ordinarily be a filial duty, cremating Ra's remains. A letter scheduled to reach Batman in the event of Al Ghul's death helps Batman fix a dangerous ecological shift. Batman was the only person he could entrust with this task, which was the legacy to bestow upon his surrogate son. Merging Henri Ducard and Ra's al Ghul into a single character in the motion picture Batman Begins, instead of being two unrelated characters as they are in the comic books, gave Bruce an amalgamate bad father figure who would teach him skills but dares to challenge Bruce's loyalty to his birth father. This chapter keeps coming back to Batman Begins, the story that best demonstrates the ongoing father-son issues underlying our hero's campaign. Hunting for the knowledge and skills that will let him face and use fear, Bruce is also searching for a father's guidance. Warm Thomas Wayne versus cold Henri Ducard, a.k.a. Ra's al Ghul, clash across time to teach him different lessons. Ducard's violent methods, disdain for compassion, and grand plan to hurt the Wayne city all drive Bruce back to the values from his true upbringing. Ducard Al Ghul, Liam Neeson. "When I found you in that jail, you were lost. But I believed in you. I took away your fear, and I showed you a path. You were my greatest student. It should be you standing by my side, saving the world. Bruce, Christian Bale. I'll be standing where I belong, between you and the people of Gotham. Ducard's League of Shadows has created the conditions that drove Joe Chill to commit robbery and murder. Create enough hunger and everyone becomes a criminal. Topping off this revelation that his manipulations indirectly killed Bruce's parents, Ducard sets Wayne Manor ablaze and heads out to destroy their city. He leaves Bruce to die, having given up on him. The Good Fathers. Bruce, in Batman Begins, must rely on all his good fathers at the film's climax. After failed father figure Ducard Al Ghul leaves Bruce to burn to death, Alfred Pennyworth, the man who has helped Bruce raise himself as best he can, rushes into the burning building to save him. Bruce despairs that he has failed to protect everything my family, my father, built. So Alfred reminds him, "The Wayne legacy is more than bricks and mortar, sir." Then channels wisdom from Thomas Wayne to convince him. Alfred, "Why do we fall, sir? So that we can learn to pick ourselves up." Bruce, "You still haven't given up on me." Alfred, "Never." Alfred Pennyworth saves Bruce Wayne. Then Lucius Fox and James Gordon each help Batman save Gotham's people. These three occupy different places in Bruce's life, filling distinct roles as they father his different personas. The film's three-scene epilogue gives each good father his own denouement and ends with him preparing for the future. Lucius Fox takes his place as Wayne Enterprises' CEO, securing the future of the family business. Alfred helps Bruce sift through Wayne Manor's smoldering remains, where Bruce finds Thomas Wayne's old stethoscope, and Alfred suggests that as long as they're rebuilding the manor, they should take this opportunity to improve the Batcave. Gordon shines the bat signal right where he'll start and end the next film, as he frets about escalation and reveals the Joker's calling card. In each of Nolan's movies, this Jim Gordon sets up the sequel. The 1939 comic book readers first met Bruce Wayne through Commissioner Gordon. Bruce appears to be nothing but Gordon's rich friend, a literary foil, a sounding board for Gordon's exposition about that mystery man in the bat costume. The final panel, after Gordon's last exit, reveals Bruce in the vigilante's costume. In the comics, Gordon works with Batman. Alfred helps out in the Batcave and maintains the Wayne Manor household, and Fox ties Bruce to his parents' charities and business. Lucius Fox's role as a gadget guru, the Batman Begins version of James Bond's Q, suited the film's story and made so much sense that comic book Batman seems incomplete without a Q of his own, although that's not Fox's role in the comics. He runs the Wayne family business. In his bow tie leading a Wayne Enterprises business meeting at the end of Batman Begins, that's the comic book Lucius Fox. Trusting him lets Bruce focus on his real work, just like his father, wealthy beyond belief, finds greater meaning in his own life by working as a physician. Bruce, "Is that where you work?" Thomas, "No, I work at the hospital. I leave the running of our company to much better men." Bruce, "Better?" Thomas, "Well, more interested men." When cool, imperturbable Lucius Fox enters the comics to save Wayne Enterprises from financial ruin, consequence of Bruce's neglect, he adds a new dimension to Bruce Wayne's world and character. By making Bruce conscious of their business and the business world, despite the Wayne heirs' efforts to ignore the whole shebang, Fox forces Bruce as Bruce Wayne to become a bit more of a real human being within their fictional universe. Fox guards the Wayne's finances, not Batman's secrets. In most accounts, he's not privy to Bruce's dual identity. Visiting the offices of the Daily Planet in Metropolis one time, Bruce watches Perry White. Seeing that smart, no-nonsense man who supervises Clark Kent's reporting, a man surely smart enough to realize Superman is Kent and trustworthy enough to keep it to himself, leads Bruce to think similarly about Fox. Bruce wonders if he and Clark might enjoy fuller lives if they were to confide in these great men. It's a tough call. Yes, Bruce might become a better-rounded human being if he could be more open with someone else who knows him first as Bruce instead of Batman. On the other hand, though, he could start feeling more like he's really Batman around Fox, in which case there'd be even less Bruce than before. To some degree, this happens in the film The Dark Knight. By not admitting the secret, comic book Bruce has to listen to Fox's business concerns instead of saying, "I don't care, I'm Batman. Pretend I'm still here and cover for me." Distractedly hearing Fox while waiting for the sun to set so Batman can come to life, Bruce will accidentally learn some things, much like Alfred hopes that if Bruce pretends to have fun long enough, he might wind up having some. Compliance breeds acceptance. Role-playing recasts reality, another byproduct of cognitive dissonance. Alfred, when you told me your grand plan for saving Gotham, the only thing that stopped me from calling the men in white coats is when you said that it wasn't about thrill-seeking. When and how does Bruce tell Alfred, "I want to sneak around in a mask. Lend me a hand"? There's no definitive account of this because it probably happens by degrees. A morning boy says he wants to go into law enforcement. Nobody's going to put down that dream. By most accounts, Bruce is college age before he concludes that dispensing justice in Gotham's corrupt climate means he must operate outside the law. His interactions with Alfred show mutual support. Alfred freely chastises him and gives unsolicited advice few servants would dare utter, expressing disagreement and worry through gentle rebukes and soft sarcasm, and Bruce doesn't view him as the hired help. Bruce sees himself as the man in charge, but he's like that with everybody. Alfred's parenting style, his general approach to child-rearing, is mostly authoritative, not authoritarian, encouraging his surrogate son's independence with warmth, nurturance, and verbal give and take, while also exerting authority, enforcing rules, and making maturity demands, expectations for age-appropriate conduct. Difficult as it may be to imagine Alfred telling Bruce at 10 or 11, "No, you may not," Bruce's social competence and self-control suggest that Alfred found ways to place limits and exert discipline, nothing corporal to be sure. The authoritative parent communicates well, listens receptively to the child's questions and requests, and teaches through explanation. The authoritative parent teaches the child more than what to do or not do. This parent teaches the child to think about why. The fact that Bruce is so accustomed to getting his own way might suggest that Alfred and Bruce's birth parents before him preferred to risk erring a little on the side of permissiveness. A permissive parent sets no limits, fails to guide and discipline, and rarely controls, restricts, or punishes the child. Some permissive parents are warm and responsive, available to help the child without seeing themselves as responsible for shaping who that child will become. Democratic indulgent permissiveness. While others are distant, uninvolved, even ignorant about what the child does, rejecting, neglecting permissiveness. Bruce's responsive, supportive father and more nurturing mother set limits. Maybe not enough. Sam Hamm, screenwriter for Batman and Batman Returns, concluded that Bruce had become Batman as a result of being spoiled. He had grown up with sufficient money and leisure to luxuriate in his own tragedy, to wallow in the false sense that it made him somehow unique. In other words, Bruce had never learned to cut his losses. Bruce shows too much self-discipline to have been completely spoiled. Alfred likely applied authoritative guidance based on logic, ethics, and Bruce's inherent guilt. "And then, when they were under the ground, he became my guardian and friend, nagging constantly and sometimes caustically, never letting me neglect my schoolwork, always keeping my obsession in check. With him, I remained driven but disciplined, anchored to vital reality through his sternness and arch humor, my soul tempered by his firm kindness and steadfast humanity." Bruce Wayne in the forensic files of Batman. Except for communicating and explaining lessons to Bruce, Ducard in Batman Begins otherwise shows an unforgiving, authoritarian style. His word is law, and his demands are high. Authoritarian parents are aloof, not affectionate or nurturing. Ducard scorns compassion. Authoritarians punish misconduct sternly, perhaps abusively. Without adequately discussing logical and moral reasoning for right and wrong behavior, much better than, because I said so, and without adequately rewarding approved conduct. The child has insufficient reason to internalize authoritarian lessons and may be ready to rebel. Domineering fathers tend to produce sons who passively acquiesce to their fathers and later may acquiesce to others, mimic the domineering styles, or overcome that domination, either by removing those fathers from their lives or by successfully standing up to them so they can redefine the relationship and move forward. Beneath Ducard's communicative veneer, he's still authoritarian. Beneath Bruce's receptiveness to instruction, he's ready to rebel for a higher cause. As soon as Bruce rejects Ra's al Ghul's League of Shadows and leaves Ducard behind on the icy mountain, there's Alfred at the airstrip ready to take him home. He's the good father that Bruce comes to depend on. Bruce's real father died before they could establish an adult relationship, and Liam Neeson's Ducard is stern and demanding, didactic and challenging, but not a father figure with any sympathy. If Bruce Wayne is anyone's son, it is Alfred's. Danny Fingeroth, author of Superman on the Couch. The Mothers. Martha Wayne gets short shrift in Batman Begins. In several scenes, Bruce and Dad do all the talking while she blinks and looks pretty. In that movie, as in Detective Comics number 33's origin story, Thomas gets shot for moving to shield her, and she gets shot for screaming over his fate. Two fearful reactions, different facets of the fight-or-flight response. Those are their roles. They die for each other. Batman Begins, like Star Wars and so many other tales of young men becoming heroes, is a father and son story. Reconciliation with the father is integral to the classic monomyth, The Hero's Journey, Chapter 9. As the hero loses his father and must move away from his father's teachings before reuniting with his father's spirit, and now with his own self-defined perspective, making peace. Heroes need mothers, too. Harry Potter offers an outstanding example of the orphan hero who idealizes both of his lost parents and must come to understand they were human beings with human foibles before he can relate to their ghosts from a more mature point of view. Only then can he appreciate the magnitude of what they did for him. If Harry Potter can do it, why can't Bruce Wayne? Because Harry doesn't snarl and bust teeth. Dr. Leslie Tompkins, the first person to notice Bruce and first to comfort him at the crime scene where his parents just died, stays involved in his life as a maternal figure, helping Alfred oversee the boy's upbringing. But without living at Wayne Manor, she doesn't take on an adoptive or foster role. Bruce does not readily include her in his secrets, and when she finds out he's Batman, she disapproves. For wearing his costume into her home, she admonishes him, and yet he does it unapologetically. Leslie provides medical and emotional aid to many of his costumed colleagues in hopes that she might help them stay safe and on an even keel until one day when they might discard those bothersome costumes. A staunch pacifist, she's the mother who worries about the child's well-being so much that she gets in the way of his fun. Stereotypically, the father occupies a place in the child's life as disciplinarian, playmate, and provider, a stereotype borne out by research. Grown sons want their father's acknowledgement and their mother's nurturance. Even if some specific issue gives a son reason to reconcile with his mother, that reconciliation with her won't characterize him as a man, not unless he'd lived henpecked by an overbearing mother. But heroes are supposed to come from stronger stock. That's how people often see these situations. So these are the themes we find woven into the stories. Sons don't as universally need to stand up to their mothers to establish who they are and redefine their relationships. Sons' self-concepts have more to do with their dads, even absent dads, than with their moms. The father, whether hero or villain himself, provides the hero with a reference for how to become a man. The mother does not, and Bruce Wayne is all man. Batman and Sons, The Legacy. Bruce doesn't know what to do with grown sons. His parents' example teaches him how to deal with children. For many reasons, he learns less about parenting from Alfred than from Thomas and Martha. The Wayne's early lessons lay his basic psychosocial foundations. Bruce grows distant from others during the years after the murders, hence the more dismissing, avoidant of his traits. Driven by his parents' demise, Bruce fixates on them. Alfred, whose approach seems more permissive than the Wayne's, goes along with Bruce's intentions of raising himself. With Martha and Thomas gone, Alfred in his domestic role becomes Bruce's mother figure, as Bruce endeavors to father himself through his adolescence. The Waynes aren't around when he gets old enough for any adolescent rebellion to kick in. Bruce leaves home at 14, after only 6 years in Alfred's care. Why try to parent the Robins the same way Alfred parented him, when Alfred's right there to do that himself? Batman relates better to the Robins when they're children. Because he doesn't grow into relating to his mother and father as fellow adults, he doesn't know how to relate to his sons as adults either. Letting those relationships mature poses problems for him. When he thinks he needs to give them their own space and let them become their own men, they feel like he's rejecting them. They, meaning Dick Grayson and Tim Drake. Jason Todd has just gotten his adolescent rebellion rolling strong when he gets himself killed. During Jason's time dead underground, comatose post-resurrection, and then in anti-hero training, he becomes a young man. So he and Bruce skip that process of relationship growth, and Jason carries adolescent rebellion on into a whole other set of problems. Dick and Tim have trouble getting Bruce to see what's wrong. Reconciling with his father isn't easy for them, because Batman's hard-headed. He doesn't get what he's doing wrong, and the standard need to say, "I'm my own man now, give me space," gets thwarted by the fact that how clumsily and bossily he gives them that space has created this friction. Once Talia al Ghul introduces Batman to the son she says is theirs, things change. Talia al Ghul and Catwoman Selina Kyle each become mothers. Bruce may have fathered either, both, or neither of their children. No internal monologue on their mother's parts at the time confirms that either believes her own paternity claim, that Bruce fathered Talia's child, or that he didn't sire Selina's. Nor does DNA testing. Not that such tests or DNA markers themselves can't be faked in the DC universe. This might explain Bruce's strangely distant manner with Damian and how uninvolved he is for a long time, entrusting Damian to the care of Dick and Alfred. Dick becomes Batman for a time, with Damian as his Robin. Bruce doesn't take a more active role in Damian's life until he resumes his place as Gotham City's Batman. Nevertheless, he accepts Damian as a son, and goes along with Selina's claim that someone else fathered her daughter Helena. After enemies' attacks repeatedly endanger her little girl, he helps Selina find adoptive parents to take in Helena, now toddling about and starting to talk. Batman starts acting middle-aged. After a period through which everyone but Tim initially thinks he's dead, he returns reinvigorated. He accepts his sons in the new roles they've assumed, and instead of getting in their way immediately, he decides to build something new, Batman Inc., an international alliance of many Batmen. How well he manages that, given his spotty history of leading teams, is another issue. It's because of the Batman that the city has the protectors it needs, I know. But I also realize that Dick, Tim, and Barbara, and all their friends, have done more together to secure our home than I ever could have on my own. This became a journey of self-identity, secret or otherwise, and my time away has helped me see everything through new eyes. The web that binds crime and justice, truth and lies, fear and hope, is too strong for one man to unravel its threats. Now more than ever, I'm prepared to accept help in expanding and accomplishing my mission. Now more than ever, I'm prepared to cast the shadow of the bat across the entire globe. Batman's journal entry and epilogue, Bruce Wayne, The Road Home, Ra's al Ghul, 2010. The midlife crisis, some individual's period of self-doubt, emotional turmoil, radical re-examination, and sudden transformation in their lives, does not happen to most people, and differs from the psychosocial crisis of middle adulthood described by Eric Erickson. Generativity versus stagnation. A midlife crisis drives the older Batman in Frank Miller's alternate future story, The Dark Knight Returns, back into his cape and cowl. But the Batman in mainstream canon starts showing generative concerns without first suffering any depressive episode. Generativity encompasses adults' desire to leave a lasting legacy of themselves. Beyond the ticking of the biological clock, the generative individual thinks broadly in terms of what he or she is contributing to the next generation, and commits to the continuation and improvement of the world that upcoming generation will inhabit. Generative adults take an interest in guiding younger adults. By contrast, those in a state of psychological stagnation, aka self-absorption, dwell on their own self-interests, unconcerned about any lasting legacy for others in the future. Stagnation sets the stage for a classic midlife crisis. The Dark Knight Returns, despite its reputation as a cynical, nihilistic piece, actually presents an optimistic forecast, progressing Bruce Wayne from utter stagnation at the story's start to generativity both personal and global by the end. Faking death to leave his old life behind and stop inspiring old enemies and old friends to make new trouble, he leads new Robin, Carrie Kelly, Green Arrow, and other followers into caverns where they will train, study, and build a do-gooder army he hopes might one day bring sense to a world plagued by worse than thieves and murderers. He decides this will be a good life, good enough. For me, that was a hopeful ending. He's looking forward to his next adventures after realizing that the methods of the past are no longer appropriate. The book starts with Bruce Wayne contemplating suicide. At the end, he's found a reason to live. He's adjusted to the times. Frank Miller, author of The Dark Knight Returns. Erickson identified one final psychosocial stage for later adulthood, ego integrity versus despair, when people reflect on the lives they've lived and the time they have left, piecing together a positive or negative review of themselves. They ask themselves, have I lived a full life? Retrospective glances back at their lives that yield healthy, not narcissistic, self-appreciation, ego integrity, convey assurance of personal proclivity and value with an acceptance of life's mistakes as necessary steps along the way. Those who evaluate themselves harshly, seeing their lives as unproductive, berate themselves for failing to meet goals. In their despair, they become dissatisfied with life, often leading to depression and hopelessness. Because readers want to read the adventures of a healthy, hale Batman, DC periodically shaves years off his age, so we'll never see the mainstream Batman officially enter this stage. Stories set in Batman's future present many different possibilities. The animated series Batman Beyond reveals a disgruntled Bruce Wayne. Finally retiring after a heart attack renders him unable to fight. This Bruce severs ties with the Justice League, forbids other Bat heroes from assuming their costumed alter egos, and shutters the Batcave, vowing never again. This Bruce Wayne, a recluse living in bitter isolation, stews in his despair. Most old Batman tales, however, depict him still thinking about generative concerns. Having spent so many years braced for the possibility that his war on crime might get him killed, he never prepares himself to start thinking like an old man. In Kingdom Come, he's the most prominent older hero, protecting Gotham with crime-fighting robots and moving about in a powerful exosuit that helps him deny the limits of age. He criticizes Superman for clinging to outdated ideals instead of keeping up with the times, and ends that story warm-heartedly teasing his ageless friends from Krypton and Paradise Island with his observation, before they can tell him themselves, that they're already working on the future generation by having a child on the way. Some tales of possible futures depict former Robins, a batsuit thief, and others succeeding Bruce in the cape and cowl, but in the present, no one can replace him for long. Batman keeps getting new sidekicks because each Robin grows up, each boy becomes a man. Each can leave the Robin identity behind as a hand-me-down for someone younger to wear, because Robin is a kid. Batman is a man, and that man is Bruce Wayne. Case File 12-1, Ra's al Ghul. Real name. If he has a name earlier than Ra's al Ghul, translated in the comics as the Demon's Head, we don't know it for certain. Pronounced Raz and Roz in Batman Begins and The Dark Knight Rises, Ra's in Batman the Animated Series and by creator Denis O'Neil. First appearance, Batman number 232, June 1971. Origin. Born in a tribe of Arabian desert nomads centuries before he first encounters Batman, scientist Ra's al Ghul discovers the Lazarus Pits with their ability to heal wounds and regenerate those at death's door. He travels the world, fights wars, learns combat techniques, expands his scientific knowledge, and amasses vast wealth and power. The international criminal cartel he creates, known as the Demon, includes the mysterious League of Assassins. Batman Begins, League of Shadows. Everything I have done, I do for the greater good. Ra's al Ghul in Batman, Death and the Maidens, 2004. Whether he's 450 or 700 varies depending on who writes the story. Creator Denny O'Neil depicts him as 450 to 500, with Ra's himself saying he's lived so long he lost track during the Black Plague. During his centuries, he sees generations of people come and go, civilizations rise and fall, while the planet spins on. Earth itself becomes his only lasting companion. He comes to see himself as a physician who must tend to his patient, the natural world, and a warrior who fights for its sake. The human race he sees as a collective body with some parts better, more useful than others, and many members as malignant cells that need to be cut out. Ra's sees Batman's refusal to kill and his efforts to save any life as short-sighted defense of the species' cancers. A ruthless environmentalist, Ra's al Ghul would eradicate billions to give the planet a good cleansing. When a forest grows too wild, a purging fire is inevitable and natural. We know tricks, small cracks in science and nature through which we have learned to slip, that rejuvenate our bodies and minds. But no mortal can count himself worthy of infinite life without a greater goal sustaining his soul. Ra's al Ghul in Year One, Batman, Ra's al Ghul, 2006. As science extends lifespan, improving both the quantity and quality of the years we might live, new patterns of later life emerge. Genetic engineering, biomedical rejuvenation, and nanotechnology could conceivably lengthen human life to the point that no current perspective on aging will apply. In his own later years, psychologist Eric Erickson acknowledged that his 8-stage theory of psychosocial development could use the addition of a 9th for extreme old age, as the average lifespan had lengthened enough during his time to open up new avenues for investigation. His widow and regular collaborator, Joan Erickson, fleshed out his notes to speculate on this unnamed 9th stage in an expanded edition of his book, The Life Cycle Completed. In their 80s and 90s, elders commonly struggle with their losses of independence, abilities both physical and mental, and significant people from their lives. Even those in the best health know that death approaches. Individuals with great trust and hope see continued purpose to their lives and face this stage by seeking enlightenment. Despair figures prominently in the stage's unsuccessful path, a different kind of despair from that of the preceding Integrity versus Despair crisis, one focused on losses and fear of death's finality. Some developmental psychologists have called this stage immortality versus extinction. Once past the average age of death, the eldest of the elders have outlived the majority of people they've ever known. Looking outside mortal life for meaning, those who achieve a sense of immortality enjoy the life they have and do not spend their days terrified about their upcoming demise because they see that they personally will continue to exist and matter beyond death. They expect continued existence by living on through their children, contributions they've made to their community, lessons they've taught other people, physical markers like a monument in a city park, the chain of nature, decomposing body joins the earth and nourishes new life, supernatural presence as a ghost or psychic residue, or unearthly afterlife. Those on the extinction side enjoy no such solace. They despair that they will simply cease to exist in every way, that they might as well never have lived. Raish ages and rejuvenates himself so many times. Where another person outliving eras might grow indifferent to anyone or anything outside himself, inoculated by the centuries to grief or any concern for all those mortals who blink by as scenery, Ra's al Ghul casts his gaze across the world and its history. He sees beauty. He's oddly hopeful that his efforts, pitiless as they may be toward individuals caught in his path, can ultimately secure the world's future. And from the first time Talia tells him about her bat-masked hero, Raish has hope that this dark detective can help secure the legacy, both by fathering Al Ghul's grandchildren and by running Al Ghul's organization to fulfill the old man's global dream. "I have too few years left, daughter. I have gone to the Lazarus Pit often, too often. Soon it will no longer restore life to my body. I must begin putting into effect my plan. My plan's to restore harmony to our sad planet. I have been called a criminal and genius, and I am neither. I am an artist. I have a vision of an earth as clean and pure as a snow-swept mountain or the desert outside." Ra's al Ghul in Batman number 244, 1972. Chapter 13. Why so serious? Batman and Robin were part of the fun. They were the straight men, but we were the stars. No one ever hurt anybody. Not really. Nobody died. You look around. It's all different. It's all changed. The Joker's killing people, for God's sake. Did I miss something? Was I away when they changed the rules? Riddler to News Crew. Secret Origins Special Number 1. 1989. I get two main reactions whenever people hear I've been writing a book on the psychology of Batman. Most think it's cool. The exceptions roll their eyes or grunt, "Huh," their way of saying, "How ridiculous," without uttering the words. Who wants to analyze a superhero? Why do we love this character? What does our interest in him say about ourselves? And what might writing a book analyzing a fictitious hero say about its author? Some would say we're taking this too seriously. We, meaning me, for writing this book, and you for reading it. To those who'd belittle analysis of a comic book character by saying, "It ain't Shakespeare," we might point out that neither are a great many topics on which psychologists and other scholars have filled library aisles, topics that have not generated multi-billion dollar businesses, fueled heated debates, inspired children's dreams, and in one way or another, enter the minds of at least half the people on this planet. The fact that cosplayers and kids at Halloween dress themselves as superheroes, along with those of us who'd pin a towel in place for a cape during our childhood playtime, should provide more reason to look at how this fiction impacts us, not less. Fiction, with its big question of what if, is one of the most powerful forces in the world. Once upon a time, the ability to light a fire was fictitious. Dark night, bright night. There's also nothing wrong with sitting back and enjoying the work without picking it apart. Analysis can be the enemy of enjoyment. I've never given any thought to the character's motivation, Burt Ward once told me regarding his playing Robin to Adam West's Batman. I don't keep up with the comic books. I'm not a fan of the character, if that makes sense. I'm an actor and I did a job. It's not for me to analyze the character. That's for the fans. That's for you. Honestly, that approach suited the way their TV series depicted Robin. It's Boy Wonder's a present-oriented character focused on the task at hand, not driven by past trauma and not thinking ahead often enough. He lives in the now. In the comic books, young Richard Grayson quickly apprehends his parents' killer, copes with their deaths, and moves ahead with his life as a spunky little adventurer, rarely referring to that tragedy. The 1960s TV series mentions Batman's tragic past, but never Robin's. And because it's Robin doesn't always think ahead, Batman regularly chastises his short-sightedness, prompting many a, gosh, yes, from the Boy Wonder. Adam, on the other hand, developed an in-depth character analysis while preparing for his role. He consulted with Bob Kane and immersed himself in the comic books, old Batman movie serials, The Shadow pulp fiction, The Adventures of Superman pilot episode, and dual identity novels like The Scarlet Pimpernel. Together with the idea of the costume as a liberating factor and cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer's observation that Batman's a bit full of himself, Adam shaped his performance by identifying six recurring features, abbreviated and semi-paraphrased here. 1. Batman risks his life for the underdog freely and without hesitation. 2. His adventures, especially the early ones, are set in the urban jungle, often among the downtrodden, which gives many of the tales a Dickensian flavor. 3. Batman is as plausible as a superhero can be, and that carries responsibilities. Batman knows there are kids out there who think they can grow up to be like him, so he's always on his best behavior. 4. He's a creature of the night, at home in the shadows, a bit of the vampire in him. Batman believes he's frightening. 5. Like Sherlock Holmes, he's a detective. He's always thinking and analyzing, maybe at the expense of his good health. 6. Batman's blessed, or cursed, with the most memorable rogues gallery this side of Dick Tracy. There's always someone flamboyant for him to play off. As a result, he must stay low-key to achieve a balance. To this day, people debate the value of their 1966 to 1968 TV series campy humor. The show has its fans, old and new, and it also has its detractors, old and new. Batman can be fun, but not everyone wants him to be funny. A future filmmaker, adolescent Michael Uslan, bemoaning the ignominy one night in 1966 after seeing too many whams and pows flash across the screen, swore an oath that would define his life much like the one that drives Bruce Wayne. Someday, somehow, I would eliminate these three little words from the collective consciousness of the world culture. Pow, zap, and wham. I would restore Batman to his true and rightful identity as the Dark Knight. A creature of the night stalking criminals from the shadows as he was originally intended to be by his creators, Bob Kane and Bill Finger. And thanks to many people who believed in that cause, when Batman and years later Batman Begins and The Dark Knight arrived in theaters, I believed I had done just that. 2012's The Dark Knight Rises would be the icing on the cake. Notice which movies he named there, the most serious Batman films. Not that Uslan shuns fun with superheroes. There's an important lesson to be learned from The Dark Knight. Unfortunately, not everyone in Hollywood gets it, he said with a sigh in his autobiography. The movie's stunning success does not mean that all comic book superhero films must be dark, gritty, and violent, and set in contemporary times. But that's exactly what the industry people are claiming. If that's the case, duck and cover, because it may just spawn movies like Casper the Unfriendly Ghost. But Iron Man, a huge success, which I saw 3 times in the first week, is just plain fun. Aha! There's room for many tones in our superheroes. Again, there's that distinction of fun versus funny. Are we supposed to take this one seriously or not? Viewers ask of every comic book adaptation. Batman Returns and Batman Forever had a few inconsistencies when answering that question. And Batman and Robin failed because, unlike the 1960s TV series, which was strictly camp, or Nolan's movies, which strictly are not, those movies mixed camp into a film series that had not set out to be campy. The Bat Symbol credit card Batman whips out to outbid Robin at a charity auction in Joel Schumacher's Batman and Robin spits on Uslan's adolescent vow. Self-conscious camp takes us outside the situation. What got lost in Batman and Robin is the emotions aren't real, screenwriter Akiva Goldsman admitted. The worst thing to do with a serious comic book is make it a cartoon. Marvel Studios' Kevin Feige called it possibly the most important comic book movie ever made. So bad that it demanded a new way of doing things. It created the opportunity to do X-Men and Spider-Man. Adaptations that respected the source material and adaptations that were not campy. Iron Man, X-Men, and Spider-Man have their moments of humor within the context of specific situations. Humor meant to play naturally off the characters' personalities or take jabs at some of the insanities of life, not by demeaning the characters and the importance of their lives. What humor we find in Nolan's Batman movies grows organically out of the characterization, much of it humanizing Bruce's relationship with Alfred. Accomplice? I'm going to tell them the whole thing was your idea. Along with some morbid humor from villains. Think Joker plus pencil, or Two-Face plus seatbelt. Your driver. Too many dramatic stories authors populate their worlds entirely with characters who have no sense of humor. But in real life, no matter what horrible thing happens, someone will need to cope through humor. Many a funeral is followed by graveside moments when mourners laugh through their tears, while sharing moments from the lost loved one's life. Some humor celebrates life. Some mocks it. Humor and drama can mix, depending on the nature of each. Now Mr. Uslan has his dark night. I, of course, am the bright knight, Adam West said, sitting beside Uslan before our packed Comic-Con audience the day they finally met in person. We had a different take. Even those who could enjoy both Uslan's dark night and West's bright night sometimes had problem with the odd humor that infected the Burton Schumacher films. Only a little bit in the first one, but then it kept spreading through them like a virus that eventually killed that four-movie series. Director Joel Schumacher, a man capable of making serious, intelligent films, Flatliners, A Time to Kill, gave the studio and Batman Forever and Batman and Robin the films he'd felt they wanted. Warner Brothers studio heads had desired something more upbeat than Batman Returns. Schumacher would have preferred to shoot Batman Year One, but the studio had no reason to reboot a successful series after only the first two. 8 years had to pass between 1997's Batman and Robin and 2005's Batman Begins, more than long enough to declare the Burton Schumacher series legally dead, the way Wayne Enterprises' CEO has Bruce Wayne declared dead in Batman Begins, Christopher Nolan's variation on Batman Year One. Batman had to wander away, die, and come back reborn. Humor is a vital coping mechanism. It's subjective, quixotic, and tough to pin down. It can be dry or absurd, good-natured or mean. What's funny now won't be funny later. What's hilarious to you might bore me. If you map out comedic formulas, humorists overuse them, and they grow less effective. Humor relies on many of the same elements of incongruity and surprise that horror doles out. Humor can swing like a weapon, drawing deep, and we may get defensive when it jabs at our heroes. An insult that belittles our heroes insults us for looking up to them. Adaptive styles of humor build people up, whether through affiliative humor, which enhances our perceptions of others, or self-enhancing humor, which promotes us. Maladaptive styles of humor, on the other hand, tear people down. That includes those weapons of attack, aggressive humor, meant to objectify, ridicule, or humiliate others, and impediments to ourselves, self-defeating humor. Because humor is an evaluative response appraising funny versus unfunny, emotionally we're ready to evaluate humor in other ways as well. Our basic adaptive inclinations have readied us to react to humor like we'd size up potential allies and enemies, which then primes individuals who have aggressive natures or poor self-esteem to see offense where none was intended.